We have invited one of our favorite regular guests, Bob King, to join us tonight. He's a photographer and photo editor at the Duluth News Tribune and an amateur astronomer. But his credentials include membership in the American Association of Variable Star Observers, where he's a regular contributor, the International Meteorite Collectors Association, and the Arrowhead Astronomical Association. Bob has written the AstroBob blog for the Duluth News Tribune since 2008. We all know that part of the North Shore experience is watching the dark skies on a clear night, and AstroBob is on the phone with us now to help us understand what we are looking at. Bob King, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be in the Roadhouse.
I'm going to ask you about specifics that we're going to see in the sky, because it does look like the sky is going to clear off this weekend nicely. But before we do that, I just think we should talk a little bit about the scale of things out there that we're looking at. I read that the observable universe has a radius of about 46 billion light years, recognizing that's a pretty much of an estimate. But where are we in that 46 billion, 92 billion light year across observable universe? Where's the Earth?
You don't start with any easy questions.
Yeah, I know.
Well, there is no way to reckon exactly where the Earth is. I mean, essentially, we're in the center of the universe. And just about anything that you can look out
good,
and
good
see.
Good point.
The observable universe is actually so minute, according to the latest theories, that 46 billion, as big as it sounds, is a very tiny portion of what could be a potentially infinite universe. So we might as well just say we're as close to the center as anybody else.
And with the naked eye, of course, we can see very little of that, right?
Well, that's a great question. With the naked eye, you can get out, like if you look at the Milky Way on a dark night, and you'll see, if you look closely, you can see some of the fainter stars sort of sparkling across the Milky Way. And those stars are several thousand light years away. Those would be the faintest stars you could see, probably around, 3,000-5,000 light years tops, and that would be a very faint star in the Milky Way band. But typically, the stars that you see when you walk outside at night are dozens to hundreds of light years away. So you can still see pretty far, provided the sky is clear.
So those stars that you're talking about that are that far away, are they in our galaxy or outside of it?
They're all in.
All
every
in.
Single one. Every star you can see belongs to the galaxy. All the individual ones, and then where they concentrate in the band of the Milky Way, again, all in the galaxy. Even with a telescope, you can't see any other stars in a typical telescope in a galaxy, except in one rare instance when they explode as supernovas. And then you can see it. It looks like a bright star, but that star had to destroy itself to become visible at such a great distance.
Well, yeah, but okay, so when it becomes a supernova and blows up like that, it's out there for many years, is it not, in that condition? I mean, you can see it for a long time, or not.
Well, no, actually not that very long at all. The star has been there all along, and maybe no one has ever, even with a large telescope, been aware of it. It's there because it's so many light years away. We're talking millions of light years now, that it just doesn't stand out at all. But then when it self-destructs, it suddenly becomes millions of times brighter. And then it stands out, and you can even see it in a small telescope sometime if you know just where to look.
For how long does it last?
For how long? They typically last, as far as seeing them in a telescope, probably several months. But if you have a giant telescope, you can follow some supernovas for, I want to say, a year perhaps, longer than that, maybe several years, and then they fade back into the backdrop. Of course, they've also blown themselves apart, so the star itself is gone, and what you have left, and what radio telescopes can still track, is an expanding shell of debris. And then maybe at the very center of that, it's created itself a little neutron star or even a black hole, as the what's left over. And those are very, very tiny and very energetic. But yeah, as far as being able to actually see it, a couple of months at the most for a typical amateur telescope.
So with the naked eye, we can see very little, but with other aids, we can see a lot. Talk a little bit about the types of instruments we use to see beyond the naked eye observable universe?
Well, just any, even a pair of binoculars. For instance, there's two asteroids out right now, the two largest and brightest asteroids, Ceres and Vesta. We even sent a spacecraft to Vesta about a year or two ago. We're headed for Ceres early next year. Those you can't see with your naked eye. They are just one level fainter than what the naked eye can pick up. So you can spot those in a pair of binoculars. And if you get a small telescope, what would be like a 6-inch telescope, that will take you out to the realm of the galaxies. Plus, you'll be able to see lots of details on the planets, like Saturn's ring. You can see the belts of Jupiter, its four brightest moons. It's remarkable what a small telescope can really do. If you're persistent and you're willing to put up with some occasional cold weather and mosquitoes.
Yeah, right. Cold weather and mosquitoes usually don't go hand in hand, but
either one is weather.
Right.
I'm saying that now because I've been out in the buggy nights and I like the colder weather. But yeah, even again, a pair of binoculars, especially for your listeners who might have a pair, mm-hmm. just go out at night, allow your eyes to adapt to the darkness for 5 or 10 minutes, and then point those binoculars at the Milky Way when the moon's out of the sky, that big glowing cloudy arch that's now way up in the eastern sky at nightfall. And you can begin to resolve or to split that hazy fuzz into individual stars, even in a pair of binoculars.
Well, I think you would agree that the northeastern Minnesota, we're in a sort of semi-unique situation or very favorable situation for observing the skies.
Yeah, we're fortunate, especially up the shore and in Grand Marais area, not to have much light pollution. Duluth's another matter. You have to get a little further away from the city here to have dark sky. But along the shore, it's so easy to go inland a mile, you know, and you've got spectacular sky.
For an amateur telescope, what kind of money does a person have to spend to get something that's worth buying?
I usually recommend a 6-inch or 8-inch reflecting telescope on this swivelly simple mount called the Dobsonian mount. And those telescopes, 6-inch is approximately, I want to say, about $250. Mm-hmm. And an 8-inch, which will get you further out there and take in more light, so things will look brighter in the 8-inch, that's probably around $500 mm-hmm. or so.
All right. Then you have to spend a little more to get a radio telescope, I presume.
Yeah, even I don't have one of those. No, I'm on the, I'm an optical guy. I know people that build their own radio telescopes. You can. People, amateurs, build their own little radio telescopes
really?
That can pick up stuff that Jupiter sends out, these pulses of radiation as Moon Io.
Yeah, but they're not seeing these spectacular
pictures.
They're
not seeing anything. Yeah, No, they're just getting charts. Just charts.
But
it's much better to look.
The Hubble telescope, now that's one that really has opened a lot of people's eyes, I think, to what the universe really looks like out there.
Oh, it's beautiful, the images that come down from the Hubble. Yeah.
And you put some of them on your blog, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I'm kind of a regular user of the Hubble images. If anybody's interested in seeing a beautiful selection of everything that the Hubble has taken, they can go to a website. They can just type into their browser Hubble Heritage, just those two words, Hubble mm-hmm. and Heritage. And you'll be taken to a wonderful gallery of Hubble images.
Spectacular pictures.
Yeah.
We're speaking now with Bob King, who's a photographer, photo editor at Duluth News Tribune, and writes a blog on astronomy for the Duluth News Tribune here. And he's joining us to help us understand what we're looking at when we look at the sky. So now you've got some specific things out there that are happening right now. One of the things that everybody can see without binoculars or anything is the moon. And we've got some interesting circumstances with observing the moon right now. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, we've got, everybody likes super moons, right? Who doesn't like a super moon? That's when the moon is full, when it's closest to the Earth. So we get a full moon every month, but it doesn't always coincide at the time when it's closest. Well, it turns out that tonight through tomorrow morning, it's closest and it's full. So we're going to be able to see a little bit brighter, a little bit larger moon than normal, and that's nicknamed a supermoon. So the only problem is with all the supermoons is that there's no comparison. There's not a second regular-sized moon up there you can say, hey, look, it is really bigger. But in truth, it will be slightly bigger and slightly brighter tonight. And it keeps going because we have a unique set of unique circumstances. There are three supermoons in a row, as it turns out. This is the first one, and then our next one will be August 10th, and then the third one in a row here will be September 8th. So that happens periodically where you get a couple in a row of close moons at full. So they'll be a little brighter than normal. And you may notice that, or you might just say, my gosh, what a fantastic moon tonight.
I can't imagine what it's going to look like coming up out of the lake because, you know, how the moon always looks so much larger when it rises out of the horizon. Why in the world is that? Why in the universe is that?
People are still trying to figure out the reason behind that. It's kind of complicated, but I guess it has to do basically with our perception of things. When we look at something and we see it along the same line of sight as we see regular things on the earth, like houses and trees and lakes, we tend to inflate the size of the moon. We don't even do it. It just happens in our minds, in our heads, compared to looking at the moon much higher up when it's divorced from all of its normal environment, from houses, trees, buildings, etc. So it just looks smaller that way. Of course, it doesn't really change size. It's actually larger when it's up overhead than it is when it's near the horizon.
Because convince me of that. No, when it comes out of the lake, it's much bigger.
it actually looks larger when it's overhead. The reason is because when you look at it on the horizon, you're looking all the way across half the diameter of the earth. You're
further away, yeah.
Okay. Further away than when it's up above you. So, you know.
It's pretty tricky. I guess you're right.
But it is. But the effect is wonderful to see it come up and look large like that. But it's an illusion.
And the moon is another one where if you have a pair of binoculars to look at it, you can see a lot of features that with the naked eye you can barely discern.
Yeah, it really does show, especially at half phase, when it's half a moon. If you look with a pair of 7-power or 10-power binoculars, pretty typical size, you can see craters, individual craters along the day-night line of the moon on the half. It's amazing how much binoculars will reveal.
Because you're getting shadows.
You're getting shadows, right, because the sun's coming in at an angle there. Whereas at full moon, the sun is shining directly on the moon's face. So all the shadows are covered. But what you can see at the full moon is the white areas of the moon, which are called the lunar highlands. That's the original ancient crust of the moon. And then those dark spots that make the face of the man of the moon, those are actually enormous craters created by asteroid impacts about 3.94 billion years ago. Then they fill with lava, and that's why they're a little darker than the rest of the moon. They're slightly younger than the lunar crust. You can see that with your eye, and you can get an even better view in binoculars.
Okay, now
there's just tons of great stuff out there.
Yeah, another one that's pretty fascinating, although this is not something that we have to worry about in our immediate near future, but you have some images of colliding galaxies out there, which brings us around to what's ever going to happen to our galaxy someday in the future. But tell us a little bit about what you're talking about with that colliding galaxy that you're showing on your blog.
Well, galaxies do collide. What's going to happen with us is that I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of the Andromeda Galaxy. It's the largest, closest galaxy to the Milky Way, and it looks a little bit like the Milky Way. It's a spiral. And it turns out that it's approaching us at, I believe, something like 300 miles a second, which sounds like a very fast speed, except that it's 2.5 million light years away, so it's going to take a little time to get here. But it will arrive. It will arrive in around 4 billion years, which is a long time. And when it does, it and the Milky Way are going to kind of do this little dance around one another, and then they're going to merge together into one super galaxy. So So lots of fun is coming for our future descendants.
And there will be large explosions. And, I mean, you've got an image, a telescopic image, apparently, of colliding galaxies that give us a little preview of what it's going to be like 4 billion years from now.
Yeah, what happens is that right away you might think that stars are going to crash into each other, but there's way too much empty space between the stars for that to happen generally.
Mm-hmm.
Stars pass right by one another without crashing. But the bigger things in galaxies, which are these huge gas clouds that can be many light years across, they do collide. And when they do, they can collide, spin around, collapse, and form star clusters. So we often see beautiful, brilliant blue star clusters that are formed when two galaxies collide. They just sort of light it up like fireworks across the spiral arm.
Yeah, well, the image you have on your blog is really quite beautiful. And before I forget to do it, let's just say your blog is astrobob.areavoices.com. That's where you can find Astro Bob's. I'm sure you can Google Astro Bob and get the same thing. But at any rate, it's a lot of fun for our listeners to know about that and to be able to look at that. Now, I just want to wrap up with a couple of quick comments on two more things. One is solar flares that you mentioned that are going on now and whether they're different or more significant than usual. And finally, the meteor showers that are coming in August.
Oh, okay.
What's the deal on those solar flares?
Okay, one quick thing before we go into that, just to mention something else for people to look for, is in the southwestern sky, in the next few nights, if you look towards the southwest, about halfway up, maybe a third of the way up, you'll see two bright stars near one another. That's the planet Mars, and it's approaching the star Spica, and they're going to be getting closer over the next few nights, so you can watch for that. That'll look kind of cool.
Hmm.
And the solar flares, we've had some gigantic sunspot groups. I mean, these things are big enough to see with the naked eye with a filter, proper filter. And unfortunately, they've not been spitting out lots of solar flares, lots of storminess, but you never know. They
Why is that unfortunate?
Well, I always say unfortunate. I'm sorry. I'm such an aurora madman.
I love seeing
the northern light. And anytime a sunspot group, you know, the magnetic ends get crossed and the energy is released from the group as a flare, often it'll kick a piece of the sun's atmosphere out into space called the solar wind. And when that arrives here at the Earth a day and a half later, those tiny subatomic particles can hook into our magnetic field and travel right down to the atmosphere and spark up a display of the northern light. That might happen still, but right now, even though they look huge, they look like they have potential, they're kind of quiet for flares. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what to say. There's nothing in the forecast right now.
Tell me just a couple of sentences about the Perseid meteor showers.
Oh, yeah. The Perseids will be maxing out here on August 12th and 13th. And the only drawback on this year's shower will be the moon.
Oh.
The moon will be bright, and it will spoil some of the shower. But, you know, there's usually up to 60 to 100 perseids an hour on a dark night. So I think even with the moon out, it's worth heading outside those nights and just looking up. I think you'll see at least 20 per hour.
So we're going to be seeing what we folks call shooting stars, okay?
Yeah, right.
Thank you so much, Bob. I have a gazillion other questions to ask you, but we've got to move along here. And with our North Shore Experience pledge drive going on right now, we really appreciate you joining us for that and giving
my pleasure.
Giving us all the information you've given us on the night skies. Thank you very much, Bob.